You're listening to Deviant, a true crime podcast. I'm Mishka.
And I'm Husband Stuff.
And this week we are covering the Seattle Excedrin poisonings.
What the fuck is Excedrin?
Well, Excedrin is basically paracetamol plus in America.
What? So well, paracetamol and caffeine?
Paracetamol, aspirin and caffeine, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I need to hear this one because I don't understand what the hell happened here.
Okay. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Attempt two at recording an episode for you in the last few days.
Yeah, this is our second go. We did actually sit and record on Sunday.
Sunday, and
we?
I am so disappointed because it was really funny, and I'm not a funny person, so anytime I can make someone laugh, I'm always really pleased with myself, and this one was really funny, and unfortunately the recording is absolute garbage.
Why is it garbage, darling?
Because I accidentally, somehow, switched the microphones over, so instead of the lovely crisp Yeti sound that you're getting at the moment, I accidentally flipped over to my laptop's internal microphone. And not only that, it was also on the floor about 5 feet away from us.
So instead of like this, it's more...
Yeah. And I tried for ages to clean it up and it is honestly not worth listening to. So what we've done is we've tucked that episode away. We're not going to tell you what it was on and we will redo it with someone as a guest because obviously part of the point of this podcast is that Stuff has never heard these stories before. And we are getting his first-time reaction. It doesn't have quite the same fun to it once he already knows what's going to happen.
Although, I suppose, if there's enough demand for it, we could put it on the website, which eventually I will get to make him. I did actually announce in the beginning of our last recording.
Yes.
Well, obviously, you can't hear that. But I will be making a website for the podcast.
Yeah. So that we can have all our episodes together. Mm-hmm. We'll be able to put all of our sources in a more accessible format for you. You might actually get to see our faces if that's something that you want.
Terribly sorry for that on my part.
He's a weirdie with a beardie.
Yeah.
I love your beard.
Good.
Even though it's a gargantuan at the moment.
Yeah, well, we are in COOF 2020. So
we are. God, nearly October. What happened? So, yeah, what we'll be doing this week is we're recording this one for you now to go out on the Wednesday. And then later in the week, we're going to do a mini-sode where we swap roles. So Stoff will be telling the story and I will be reacting. And the challenge is for him to find something that I don't know. So without further ado then. Oh, wait, no, more ado. Because I did do this in the last episode
yes.
And then we lost it.
We're covering already... What's the saying?
Huh?
What's the saying for that?
What?
Okay, I don't fucking know. Someone will know what I'm talking about.
So there is a bit more ado. First of all, this is my third attempt at correcting myself. I accidentally edited it out the first time. And the second time, the recording is buggered. So,
right, okay.
Third time's the charm.
How many chromosomes
yes.
does a person have?
They have 23 pairs of chromosomes.
Pairs?
Making 46 in total. They do not have 46 pairs of chromosomes, which is what I claimed in our first parter of our Gypsy Rose Blanchard cover.
And how bananas related to this?
It's not bananas.
What was it?
Daffodils.
Really?
There's only 11 chromosomes difference between a human being and a daffodil, which I thought was fun.
There you go.
Secondly.
And also, from the recording we done last, we also then wanted to talk about aliens.
Yes, but we're not doing that now because we've already waffled a lot.
As in James Cameron, Geiger. Continue.
Secondly, I want to give a shout out to our first interactive follower, Kerry. Hello!
You're not a guinea pig. We discussed this last time.
There was a long, winding conversation about the fact that you have the same name as one of our guinea pigs, but that it's not spelt the same. So Kerry is our first member in our Facebook group. She's also currently the only member, bless her. So you all need to come and join and keep her company and chat nonsense together so that she's not all on her lonesome because she is very lovely. So Hello, Kerry. Thank you very much for listening.
Hello, both Kerrys, because the other one can hear us from here as well.
Yes, we might post a picture of the other Kerry because Stoff got a little bit fixated on the fact that you have the same name last week.
Kerry.
Right, let's get into the case because we've already piffle-puffled about for a while.
Yeah, let's talk about murder in paracetamol.
Yes, we are talking about murder this week. You asked me to go back to murder because after what I covered last week.
Yeah, crikey.
You can't hear.
The last one was just a head fuck.
Which you can't hear.
No.
I'm so sorry, guys.
Well, join the Facebook group. If you really want to hear this terrible sound quality with bits that you can't actually understand a goddamn word of, let us know. And we might not put it up as our regular podcast schedule, but we might put it up separately, like on the Facebook.
Yeah, if you really want it, we can put it somewhere for you. But it's not good enough sound quality to be uploaded to our normal schedule. So sorry, I'm just sorry. Yeah,
we will be.
I'm so sorry.
But like you say, we will be revisiting with some new blood to get some new reactions for it.
Yeah. Oh, God. I'm so disappointed. I really am. But what's done is done. Let's move forward.
Yes. Onto the paracetamol.
Well, specifically Excedrin, the brand. That's important.
Right, okay.
Okay.
Right.
Right, so on June the 5th, 1986, at 5:02 p.m., an emergency call was placed in Seattle, Washington. It was a woman's voice on the line. Her name was Stella Nickel, and she was calling for an ambulance because her husband, Bruce Nickel, was having a seizure. Volunteer firefighters were dispatched to answer the call. When they arrived, they found Stella waiting at her front door, oddly calm as she led them inside the house. Inside, Bruce Nickel, still wet from having a shower and wearing only a dressing gown, was flat on his back on the floor, glassy-eyed and gasping for breath. Stella explained that he was a recovering alcoholic and smoker, but other than that, he had no health issues, aside from occasional headaches. He had simply told her he was feeling a bit lightheaded and then collapsed. She explained that he'd had one of these headaches when he'd come in from work that day and taken 4 Excedrin capsules, a common over-the-counter medicine comprised of aspirin, acetaminophen, which is paracetamol, and caffeine.
Or?
Yeah. Always stick to the recommended dose, guys.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Surely 2's kind of...
Yeah, more than enough, you would think.
Okay.
She gave the bottle of pills to the firefighters as they worked to save Bruce. He was given an emergency tracheotomy on the floor of his home and airlifted to hospital.
A what?
Do you not know what a tracheotomy is?
No.
Okay.
Where they jab a hole in your throat?
Yeah, it's where they cut into the windpipe and they insert a tube, basically, because... There's too much compression. Huh?
Your tongue will swollen up.
It's not that your tongue's swollen up, it's that your air pipe is constricting and there's too much compression on it to be able to catch a breath. So by inserting the tube, it forces it open and it also bypasses some of the swelling. So you're then breathing through your throat rather than through your mouth and your nose. And it's one of those things where it's a really kind of aggressive procedure. So yeah, it's a really... bad situation if it's got to the point where they've had to do that.
Okay.
So Bruce was given an emergency tracheotomy on the floor of his home and airlifted to hospital. His wife Stella did not follow. Bruce died at 8:45 p.m. that evening. He was only 52 years old. So, yeah, perfectly normal guy.
Why did it take 4?
I'm going to give you a clue now. It wasn't the amount of pills that he took that killed him. I guess he had a really bad headache. I've done that before. I've taken 6 ibuprofen when I've had a migraine.
Yeah, but...
I got bollocking for it once from the doctor, but you can take like up to safely. No, don't do that. I'm not recommending it.
Yeah, you might have to... I wouldn't say edit this out, but just beep it.
Mm.
Just beep this bit. Let's not give medical advice for our listeners.
So, a bit of background about Stella. Stella was born Stella Maudine Stevenson in Colton, Oregon, to parents Alva Georgia, known as Coralie, and George Stevenson, on August the 7th of 1943. She was the youngest of 5 living children then, with 3 sisters and an older brother. George was a lumber mill worker, Coralie a stay-at-home mum. The family was poor and George had issues with drinking. Often he and Coralie would go out drinking all night, leaving the children to fend for themselves. There was abuse of the children, both physical and sexual, which would only escalate when George had been drinking. Things came to a head when one night he came home after a poker game, got into a fight with Coralie, and pointed a shotgun at her. Coralie told the children to run, and as they all sprinted out towards a neighbour's house, George shot after them all. I would class that as a dick move.
Yeah, I wouldn't put that high on the parenting to-do list,
no.
I'd say.
No. I would say the father is probably a dick in this case.
Yeah.
After this, Coralie divorced George and briefly relocated herself and her children to Colorado to keep them all safe until the divorce was finalised and she ensured George could not get custody of her children. Once the worst was over, they returned to Oregon, and this time Coralie went to work at the lumber mill herself to provide for her family. She always said that she could do the job as good as any man. The children would help where they could, looking after the home and cooking meals. One evening in 1948, while one of Stella's older sisters, Mary Bell, was lighting a fire at the family home, she accidentally lit a can of kerosene, thinking it was coal oil that they used for starter fuel, and the can erupted into flames. Mary Bell threw the can of kerosene outside, not knowing that Stella was playing on the front porch, and the can splashed burning kerosene all over the little girl, leaving her with serious burns. It took 2 months of surgeries and skin grafts for the five-year-old to recover.
Bloody hell.
Yeah.
These clothes can't catch a fucking break.
No, oh God, they really can't. And I mean, I'm not one to ever feel sorry for murderers, but I can feel sorry for the child that person used to be. So in this case, I can feel sorry for five-year-old little Stella.
Yeah.
And still think that she's a scumbag in later life.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think she's really had a good start in life.
Not at all.
With it, well, like the shotguns and the various forms of abuse.
It doesn't get any better, unfortunately. In 1949, Coralie met a new man, a logging truck driver named Culver Dewey Kelly, and the two got married. When they'd met, he'd seemed like a perfect gentleman, but after the wedding, things declined, and once again, the home was filled with alcoholism and abuse. It's just, like I said, they can't catch a fucking break. The pair had another child in 1952, and the family of eight lived in a home of two rooms after moving to Lackawanna, Washington. Dewey and Coralie fought constantly, and Stella remembers once watching Dewey hit Coralie so hard in the face that he knocked out all her teeth. Yeah, and after that she had to wear a denture.
Oof.
Not a nice man.
No.
One day, Dewey told Coralie that he was going to do a trucking job up in Alaska that would make some real money for the family. He left, but he never came back. And Coralie was now left with six children to fend for herself. She was probably still better off, though, in my opinion. I don't think that's a particularly sad point of the story. I think, you know, offity fuck. Coralie relocated her family several more times after this, before finally settling in Seattle. Stella grew up very fast. Her siblings suspected that she was sexually active before she hit 13, and by the time she was 13, she had a boyfriend who was 17, which, no shade on Coralie, but if that was my daughter, I would be calling the police on him.
Yeah.
Stella developed a wild streak and began to often fight with her siblings, once biting one of her sisters so hard on the arm that she drew blood, because Stella wanted her to get off the telephone so that she could use it. Stella wanted to be a vet, a nurse, or a model, but at 15, she became pregnant.
You sound like your job options. But, right, well, look at your CV. You can either be a vet, a doctor, a model, or you can be pregnant.
This was the 50s.
Pick a job, love.
So, like, now, teen pregnancies, I would like to think are handled a bit better. And if you get pregnant as a teenager, it's not like, right, well, your life is over. You have no options. You're a stay-at-home mum now. You know, I would like to think that the family would rally around her support and you'd still be able to finish your education and develop a career and all the rest of it. But not in the 50s.
No.
Stella told her family that she fell pregnant because she had been going out with a boy who then gang-raped her with several of his friends. Her mother told her that she should marry the baby's father. So her mother told her she should marry her rapist.
No.
That was Stella's response. She refused, convincing another boy that she slept with, Ricky Slauson, that the baby was his. This was despite the fact that the two had not started sleeping together until she was already 4 months pregnant. Stella gave birth to a baby girl named Cynthia on October the 23rd, 1959. Meanwhile, Coralie remarried once more, this time to a retired Navy serviceman, Bill Street, and relocated to Orange County, California with him, leaving her older children in Seattle. So she just left them.
Okay.
Yep.
Just reminds me of that bloody woman that ran off with her boyfriend in Spain.
Hmm?
I told you about this one a while ago.
I've blinked since then.
Yeah, you have. A few times, I think. there was a mum who fled to Spain to go be with her boyfriend, left £20 and a note on the counter for her school-age kid.
Oh, my God.
Yes. And but to top it off, to make the whole country go, what the fuck are you doing, love? They actually tracked her down, done an interview with her, and the boyfriend said, end of quote, I love she very much.
Like, you know, if you don't want to be a parent, okay, there are options. Don't just abandon your children.
£20 on the table.
God, how old were the kids?
Not very.
Oh my God.
Like,
so what, they just came home from school one day and she'd fucked off?
Yeah.
Gross. What?
And left a note.
Gross human being.
Yeah, she's a bit of a dick.
I'm judging you and I'm judging you hard and I feel like I'm within my remit too.
Oh yeah.
Ugh.
Some people
should just not be allowed to have children. In California, Coralie tried to persuade Stella to let her adopt baby Cynthia and raise her as her own. This was so that Stella could still have her teenage life and an education, but Stella refused. However, she did persuade Stella to move in with her down in California so that she could help her to look after the baby. Stella agreed to this, leaving Ricky behind. And when she arrived, she realised that once again, her mother was being physically abused by her husband. Bill beat Coralie so violently that he even broke her arm. Ricky threatened Stella that he was going to sue her for custody of Cynthia once she left. And it was only then that she revealed the baby was not his and that she'd simply tried to marry him because she wanted to ensure that her daughter wasn't a bastard. But that if he tried to make her out to be an unfit mother, she was going to press charges for statutory rape as she was only 15 when they slept together. Little bit manipulative.
Fucking hell.
Yep, don't approve of that at all. But also, Ricky, bless you, 5 and 9 are not the same number. If you only slept with her 5 months ago, that baby is not yours, love.
Was he bright spark?
I don't know.
Bit of a dim bulb.
I would say maybe not.
No.
And funnily enough, the two never ever spoke again after this incident.
Really?
Mm. Stella's wild streak only grew wider in California. She began to date a lot of older men and even referred to herself as being promiscuous. In 1962, she became pregnant again by an Air Force enlistee, but he refused to marry her and Stella actually caught him in bed with another woman. Coralie was unable to support another child in the house. Bill Street was thankfully out of the picture by this point, and Stella ultimately decided to put her second baby up for adoption. Stella and Coralie told the rest of the family that her baby had been stillborn. It's just the 60s, but like, was there that much stigma around giving up a child for adoption that having a dead baby was a better option? I find that mind-blowing.
I don't have a clue what things were like there.
Well, like the 60s, you know, fair enough, very conservative. One baby out of wedlock was bad enough. A second one, you know, Jesus fucking Christ. But how could a dead baby be better than giving up that baby for a better life? You know, no shade on Stella. She made the right choice for her and her child. So why is she then covering up by saying the kid was stillborn?
Well, what were attitudes towards adoption around then?
I don't know. I suppose it's something worth considering.
It was 1960s, yeah?
Yeah, 62-ish, I think. Yeah,
so we're post-World War II at this point.
Mm.
What was adoption like then? How many kids suddenly didn't have parents?
Well, yeah, I suppose. But could have been it's fairly far after the war. I don't know how much that would have had a bearing on it.
Yeah. I don't know. All I can do is literally just guess.
Maybe it's just the social stigma of, again, being seen as an unfit mother. Or maybe it was because she already had one baby and then she gave up the second. They were like, well, why did you keep one and not the other? I don't know.
Who knows?
I just thought that was a really bizarre choice.
Yeah, share your thoughts with us, listeners, because we don't understand what the hell's going on there.
No,
but
maybe you can give us some more perspective.
Yeah, give us some insight.
In 1964, Stella met and married Robert Warren Strong, a Korean War vet who was drawn in by her confidence and her fondness for partying as hard as men did.
What husband is this now?
This is number one. This is husband number one. She's had lots and lots of sexual partners, but she's not actually been married yet. Stella became a stay-at-home wife and mother once she married Bob, while he went to work as a contractor. But all was not well within the home. Stella had always used her body to get what she wanted, and she began to step out of her marriage. She would disappear with other men for nights at a time, and didn't so much as try to hide the fact from her husband. She gave birth to her next child in November of 1966, another baby girl named Leah, but Bob had a strong suspicion that the baby was not his. Her following pregnancy after this, she terminated and told Bob that she did not want to have any more children. Which, again, fair enough, her body, her choice. However, something
Which also does raise an entirely different question.
Mm.
If adoption has such a big stigma compared to abortion...
Abortion would have then as well. I dare say that she just didn't want to go through the trauma of giving birth and giving up another child. Because that's immensely traumatic as an experience.
Okay.
And I suppose that termination is the lesser of two evils in that scenario. You know, I can't imagine being in her position. I don't think she's even solidly into her mid-20s at this point. Her body has been through the ringer, as has her emotions.
Yeah.
Again, I can feel sorry for the person that this woman used to be, but I don't feel sorry for her for what she did next. Stella began to abuse her daughters, most noticeably Cynthia. She would hit her, slap her with leather belts, and in 1969 she beat her with a curtain rod. Police were called. Cynthia was taken from the home to a state centre for the protection of children, and Stella was arrested. Stella only served one night in jail for her assault on her child, though, and then Cynthia was returned to her. Stella was ordered to attend group therapy as part of the conditions that Cynthia be returned, but she did not complete the ordered sessions, going to only two or three of them. Don't beat your kids.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to say.
Don't beat your kids.
Don't beat your kids. And don't be part of a system that finds a beaten child and gives her back to the parent one day after she's been removed.
It's not discipline, as some would try and excuse. No. It's called being a dick.
It is called being a dick.
Don't be a dick.
If you hit your child, it is you that has lost control in that situation, not the child.
If you hit your child, I want to hit you.
We're in the hard judging territory now, guys.
Yeah. I actually remember when they were passing laws here in the UK, just like to pretty much say, don't fucking hit your kids.
Yeah.
They're interviewing people on the street. I read this one woman on the street, and she was like, I spat it my kids if I want to. They're mine.
They're not your possessions.
No, you're a dick.
God, I bet she'd treat a dog better than her child. My parental units might have given me a slap or two around the chops when I'd been a mouthy, fucking horrible teenager. Because I was a bitch when I was a teenager, and to be quite honest, I deserved it. But, like, don't beat your kids with a curtain rod.
Yeah.
Jesus fucking Christ. We shouldn't have to say things like this.
Yeah. To be honest, the only thing you're going to achieve by hitting your kids is they're going to fucking resent the shit out of you.
Yep.
And that's going to be a you problem.
Yep.
Figurative you, not as in you, listener, because I'm sure you're
none of you assault your children. I'm sure you're all lovely parents if you've got younglings.
Yeah.
But to the general universe and world out there, don't beat your fucking children.
Yeah, because I'll beat you.
Yes, and he's 6'4" and has a similar build to Shrek, I would say, without the gut.
I am. What do you mean without the gut?
You're not quite that rotund.
Just because this is voice doesn't mean we have to pretend I am like some Adonis.
You're my lovely husband. You're very attractive.
I'm an ogre.
You're an ogre. Yeah, if stuff comes to beat you, you're in trouble. You're going to end up with legs like bowls of banana pudding.
It'll be hilarious.
I've completely lost my place.
What are we talking about again?
Cynthia beating her child with a curtain rod, having her removed from her custody for one day and then returned.
That was stupid.
By a system that dropped the fucking ball.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a reoccurring theme of our story as a whole, isn't it?
I think, Child Protective Services, they're so understaffed and overworked and underfunded.
Yeah.
No matter what decade or country we're in. In 1971, Stella was found to be fraudulently claiming somebody else's welfare checks, as well as their food stamps, and cashing them all in to pay off money towards her personal debts.
Were the debts on drink and drugs, by chance?
I think she liked her drink, but I think she also just had a horrible spending habits in general.
Okay.
She at first tried to implicate her husband Bob for her crimes, but as the investigation found that she acted alone, she alone was sentenced to 6 months in Orange County Jail. Her mother Coralie helped Bob look after the children, and while Stella was in prison, Bob began dating another woman, but still loyally visited Stella in jail every week, making sure that she saw her daughters regularly. He waited until she was out of jail before filing for divorce in October 1971, explaining that she had been through enough while in jail without him adding to her problems. Bless him. Apparently he's a really nice guy. There's a couple of really nice guys in this. They're not all arseholes, not all men.
Aye, come on.
But a fair few of them in this story.
In this story, yeah.
Stella stayed with mutual friends of herself and Bob whilst they were being divorced, and would tell them things like Bob had framed her for the fraud scams, or that had been sexually abusing her daughters. She also went back to being a barfly, picking up multiple sexual partners and ingratiating herself with a local motorcycle gang. There was also a rumour that Stella tried to pay one of the bikers to kill Bob Strong, but fortunately nothing came of this. Stella went through boyfriend after boyfriend, her lifestyle and that of her daughters by proxy almost transient. Cynthia, her daughter, said that one of these boyfriends tried to molest her when she was 14, and she told her mother as much. Stella's response to this was to beat Cynthia.
That's not the right response.
It's not the right response. If your kid comes to you and says that somebody's touching them, I suggest you believe them. Don't fucking slap them about.
And go get a hammer.
No, we do not encourage vigilante justice here in the Deviant Household stuff. Naughty. We've had this discussion once already.
Did I agree?
Please hold, listeners. I'm just going to go and deal with my husband.
Hi.
Stella also flushed little Leah's pet goldfish down the toilet and smashed the children's toys. When Bob told his daughter Leah that he thought her hair was pretty, Stella cut it all off. She would take 13-year-old Cindy to bars with her and use her to draw in men. There were also suspicions that she may have been pimping her daughter out. Yeah, I stopped feeling sorry for her by now. Bob tried to fight Stella for custody of the girls, but in November of 1973, Stella packed up the girls and her latest boyfriend in her car and drove them all away from Bob up to Washington. So she was basically trying to run away from the divorce court. I don't think she should have custody of these children.
Yeah.
Fortunately, Bob didn't give up, and he was finally awarded full custody of Leah. He wanted to take Cindy too, but sadly, as she was not his biological daughter, he didn't have any right to her. So she was left behind with her mother, and ended up frequently going in and out of care homes and living with her grandmother due to Stella's neglect and abuse. Stella then met Bruce Nichol in early 1973. At the time, he was newly married, only 4 months in, but that didn't stop Stella from taking a shine to him. They met in the bar, and at the time, Bruce was severely alcoholic. His wife Phyllis had been trying to support him through his addiction, but he was having second thoughts about their marriage. And when he met Stella, he was immediately attracted to her. I just like to say, just to be a bit of a bitch for a moment.
Just to be a bitch.
I can't see how this woman... I'll show you a picture after and I'll put pictures of her up on the Instagram. Everyone, when they talk about Stella, it's like, she was so hot, she was so sexy, blah, 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 blah. I cannot fucking see it. I cannot understand how this woman was just like picking up men left, right and centre. And I suppose beauty's in the eye of the beholder, and maybe it's just an ugly soul is all I can see, but I don't get it.
It could have been her pickup lines, for example.
Mm.
Could have been, gone up to these guys and be like, I got no knickers on.
Yeah, I think that see? Was probably her style. You want to see my poon thing?
Want to see my meat grease?
Oh,
it is disgusting.
Do you remember when we used to know somebody that referred to vaginas as axe wounds?
Yeah.
and that person was a lesbian. She liked vaginas.
Yeah. To be fair, at this point, she's had like, what, 50 different partners?
I don't know. I mean, they're not slut shaming. It's more, I don't understand how she's achieving this, because I wouldn't bang her.
No. No.
And I like girls, but I don't like her.
Well, not her.
Not
she's
her.
She's a bitch.
This woman is the kind of woman that, unfortunately, is such a stereotype that she's the kind of person that gives trailer trash a bad name. Like, people who live in trailer parks, most of them are perfectly lovely people. Your nan's got a trailer and she's an absolute diamond.
And the funny thing is, listeners, within the last few months, I've got Mish really into Trailer Park Boys.
Super into Trailer Park Boys.
I used to watch it and she'd be like, this is weird. But then you said the exact same thing about Always Sunny.
Yeah.
And you watched that 100 times over.
Yeah.
And this is where some of the listeners will cringe. Rick and Morty.
Love Rick and
because
Morty.
Because it's such a meme show at the moment.
But Stella is the kind of person that unfortunately fulfills all of those stereotypes and perpetuates them and gives people who live in trailer parks a bad name.
Okay.
She's proper white trash.
She's proper white trash.
Stella decided when she met Bruce that she wanted him too, drawn in by his looks and the fact that he was holding down a good job as a heavy machinery operator, despite the fact that he was a heavy drinker.
Clearly at this point, it's got to be one of her turn-ons.
Well, the thing is that she loves a drink, so she wants a partner that can keep up with her. The two would party together all weekend, every weekend, and Stella enjoyed having a partner who could match her hard and fast pace. By March of 1974, Bruce had left his wife and was living with Stella. For a while, it seemed like the pair was genuinely happy and in love with each other, but Stella began going out without Bruce. In order to keep his job and his life under control, he had got his drinking to the point where he would only do it on the weekends, and during the week he would stay sober. So Stella, during the week, would go out without him and started to pick up men in bars. Just like during her first marriage, she began to disappear for nights at a time, then weeks. She would tell Bruce that he did not satisfy her sexually and that she was losing interest in him. Poor git. I mean, okay, yes, it's good to have honest, open communication. But don't you use that shit like that as an emotional weapon. Just not a nice thing to say to somebody.
I'm not entirely sure she's a nice person.
I don't think she is a very nice person. Her daughter Cynthia moved out and went to live with Bob Strong and his new wife Pat in 1974, leaving Stella without any motherly responsibilities at this point. And so, in a bid to try and save his marriage, Bruce packed up his trailer home and began to travel with Stella around Washington and Idaho. It seemed to do the pair some good, and when they returned to Kent in 1976, they once more seemed completely in love with each other. Stella said that she wanted to stop her promiscuous ways and be a one-man woman. Bruce was so sure that the misadventures for the couple were over that he married Stella on the 11th of September 1976. And if that's not an ominous wedding anniversary for these two, then I don't know what is.
When was it?
September 11th. Unfortunately, Bruce had hoped too much for their relationship. Stella soon returned to her old ways, and the pair frequently separated, only to later get back together. Bruce's drinking got worse, and he began to have serious trouble holding down a job. Stella claimed that his drinking habit got to the point where it was costing them $250 a week, and instead of being mutually fun, it was now a real problem that she decided to try and persuade him to get help for.
Was she still drinking at this point, though?
She was, yeah, but there is obviously a big difference between using alcohol recreationally and having a real problem.
Yeah, but was she an alcoholic too?
I don't know if she was an alcoholic or if she just liked to drink. I think the thing with alcoholism that's to the point where it's a dependency and you get withdrawal if you don't drink, and if it becomes sort of, I think one of the parameters for addiction is if it becomes destructive on the normal parts of your life. I don't know very much about addiction. If anybody wants to educate us on what makes an alcoholic versus what makes just a heavy casual binge drinker, feel free. Stella actually managed to get Bruce into rehab, finding a facility for him, and it worked the first time.
The first time.
The first time.
Spoiler warning.
No, as in he never went back to rehab again.
Oh.
He went into rehab. He came out 10 days later. He only did a 10-day course. He never touched a drop of alcohol again.
Good lad.
He did really, really well.
Good on him.
Mm-hmm. In 1979, the pair settled at a new trailer park, the Auburn Mobile Home Park, as Bruce had gotten a new job in a company there in Auburn as a machinist. And in 1980, while living their quieter life, Stella began to think of her daughters for the first time in 4 years.
Oh, she remembered they existed.
Yes, she remembered she had children.
Ah.
Cynthia had endured a hard time in the last 4 years, furiously rebelling, and by way of this, accidentally behaving just like her mother until she became pregnant at 19. Leah had not seen her mother at all in the 4 years since Bob had collected her, despite Stella's promises to visit. And she actually had visitation rights. She could have gone and seen her. She just didn't. In the summer of 1980, though, Leah went to Washington to stay with her mother for the first time. And Stella also lent some money to Cindy to help her secure an apartment for her little family. She at this time also began developing a hobby in fish aquariums and considered opening up her own business designing them. So for a while, it did seem like she was trying to sort of slow down a little bit. Emphasis on for a while.
Did it last?
No. Oh. Because Bruce's job ended up taking him to work in Alaska. And in 1982, by that point, all of the progress that had been made in their marriage was just going completely down the toilet.
Did he come back from Alaska?
Eventually. Oh. But while he was gone, Stella went back to her partying ways, and climbing into men's trucks outside the bar to have sex with them was a regular occurrence. Bruce began to get just a bad feeling about the way that Stella was talking and sort of sounding on the phone. He just had something in his gut that told him that things weren't right. And in November of 1982, he returned home to discover that Stella had gone back to her Barflow ways, and she'd also managed to accumulate debts over $20,000. Bruce once again went to work piecing his marriage back together. Unable to recover from their debts, they filed for bankruptcy and set about making a fresh start. Cynthia moved in with them for a short while with her baby daughter, though mother and daughter could not get along, and in the end, Stella threw her out in April of 1983. It was this really kind of toxic, intense relationship where they're like best friends 1 minute and absolutely fucking hate each other the next.
Okay.
And they just couldn't live together. Which I think Cindy had the right to hate her mum, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
If someone beats the shit out of you, I think you're allowed to hate them.
Yeah.
Stella's mother, Cora Lee, wanting to try and piece her family back together, managed to buy some property with acreage in Auburn so that she could help Stella and Bruce. The couple moved their trailer there, freeing them up from some of their expenses. Bruce was out of work again for a long time after he returned from Alaska. But in 1984, he found employment. And in 1985, Stella actually got herself to a job to try and ensure that they did not end up in debt again. She worked in security at an airport screening company, and this was the first real job that she had ever had.
How old is she now?
I think she's in her 40s. Yeah, she's in her 40s.
Wow.
Yep. That woman has been carried.
Yeah.
Stella hated her new job. Not unsurprising for somebody who's never worked an honest day in their life.
Mm-hmm.
And would spend much of her days just reading behind her desk. She also earned only $4 an hour, which did not go very far at all. Stella also found that although she had been the one to push him to get sober, she couldn't stand Bruce now that he no longer drank. Bruce had slowed down and didn't want to go out to bars all night anymore. He wanted to enjoy his wife's company relaxing together at home. Stella still wanted to party though, and she began doing so while leaving Bruce at home again. She would don hot pants and a cheap blonde wig, classy, when she headed out, and before long she was developing a reputation of sleeping around once more. There was also some rumours that she was engaging in sex work. Cynthia ended up working at the airport with her mother and going out with her at nights as a wingwoman, Stella treating her more like a friend than a daughter and encouraging Cynthia's recklessness. All the while, Bruce begged his wife to stop, and when that didn't work, he would fight furiously with her. Debts also began piling up once more due to Stella's spending on her party lifestyle. She started telling friends and relatives that there were serious problems at home and that she was thinking of leaving Bruce. She also once asked Cynthia how much cocaine her daughter thought it would take to kill a person. They later claimed that she was only joking.
What?
Yep. That's what we call a red flag.
Just a bit.
Just a bit.
So going. Oh, by the way, what would I need to put in your tea that you wouldn't taste as a poison?
Arsenic, FYI. Okay. Arsenic has no taste or scent.
You know why I chose that question?
Because
I knew that you would have told me.
Not that I'm plotting to kill you, I promise.
I'm on borrowed time. Send help.
It's okay, we don't have life insurance. Bruce had been married 4 times before he wed Stella, and although his relationship with his wife seemed completely untenable at this point, he really loved her and he didn't want to get another divorce. As it happened, he would never have to. Bruce tragically passed away on the 5th of June 1986 in terrible pain, without the woman that he still loved there by his side. Bruce's friends and family were devastated by his sudden passing. While he'd had his problems when he used to drink, everyone agreed that he was a gentle giant, and he was the kind of man that he would give his shirt off his back if you needed it. Adopted at 1 week old by his parents Walter and Ruth, who had struggled to conceive for 14 years, Bruce was a blessing to them. They never knew what had started Bruce drinking when he was 15, but it didn't change their love for him. Bruce's parents were in their 90s when their son died, and the news crushed the frail pair. Oh, so sad. I got a lot of this information from a book called Bitter Almonds by Greg Olson, and there's this passage about them telling his parents, and his poor dad, Walter, just goes into Bruce's, like, old bedroom and picks up a picture of him and starts sobbing. And my heart, just hurt in my chest. An autopsy conducted on Bruce ruled his death as caused by emphysema, which seemed understandable enough given his years of smoking. He was buried quickly, and Stella handled the loss of her husband with a steely-jawed grit that those who knew her were unsurprised by. Stella had always been as tough as nails. People grieved, but life had to go on. Until, on June 11th, only 5 days later, it happened again. This is where it gets really rough, guys.
Oh dear.
Sue Snow was a 40-year-old bank manager who lived in Auburn, Seattle, with her daughter Haley and her husband Paul. Sue was a warm, ambitious woman who'd always sought to build up the people around her. She too had come from a tough start in life, becoming a wife and mother very young without finishing school, but she'd always worked hard. She completed her GED through adult ed classes and grafted to climb the ladder in financial services. Paul was her second husband. Early in 1986, she discovered that he'd had an affair with a mutual friend, and it all but broke Sue's heart. But the couple had worked to save their marriage through counselling, and by June, it seemed as if things were going to be okay.
I think I can see what it is again.
Yeah. Hold that thought. On June 11th at 6 a.m, Sue got up to get ready for work. She went and took 2 Excedrin, the same as she did every morning.
2?
Yeah.
Not 4?
Not 4, no, the recommended dose.
Okay.
Sue suffered with migraines and she would take the over-the-counter medication in the morning to help stave them off. It also didn't hurt that the caffeine in the pills gave her some extra pep each morning. She didn't like coffee.
Well,
I've done that.
I don't like coffee.
Yeah, well, if I felt a bit tired and a bit shit and we've got, like, paracetamol and caffeine, I've done that before. There's been no... It's probably not something that you should do every day, but...
We've given really good advice on this podcast episode.
Huh?
We've given really good advice on this episode.
Sage,
today.
Yeah.
Yeah, disclaimer, don't take any...
Don't take any medical advice from us. We're not liable for any of the choices that you make.
Yeah, if you do decide to do something based on something we said, then you've done it yourself and you're...
Unless, like, we help you catch a murder or something. In that case, we definitely want credit.
Yeah, unless it was me, then...
No.
Exactly, don't get... I don't want to get caught.
Don't get mad. Don't murder people.
Well, it wouldn't be people.
You and I need to talk when this recording is over. At 6:40 a.m, Hayley, Sue's daughter, just 15 years old, realised that her mother still hadn't emerged from her morning shower, which was very unlike her. She went to knock on the bathroom door and called out to Sue, but there was no answer, just the sound of the shower running. Hayley let herself into the bathroom to find her mother collapsed on the floor, gasping for breath, her eyes fixed and glassy, staring into nothing. Hayley rushed to call for an ambulance and medics arrived by 6:47. With no idea what was causing her symptoms, they airlifted Sue to the same hospital Bruce had been taken to just days before and started her on respiratory support. But by 7:30 a.m, Sue Snow was brain dead. The family were forced to say their goodbyes and a little after 11 a.m, Sue was taken off of life support, taken one final breath on her own before she was gone. At first, doctors suspected that Sue had suffered a brain aneurysm, but they couldn't find any obvious signs of a bleed. With Sue's death being so sudden, and her still being so young, an autopsy was ordered to determine what had happened. I think that's pretty much standard fare in America. If you die in anything that kind of is even vaguely suspicious circumstances or unexplained circumstances, they'll order an autopsy.
Mm.
Whereas here, I think it's a bit harder to get one, so... Kudos to America on that part of their medical system, at least.
Yeah.
I mean, other bits might have massive gaping flaws, but at least they're asking the right questions.
Well, there's a vast difference between American healthcare and British healthcare.
I wonder how an autopsy gets paid for in America. Do you think it comes off their insurance?
I don't know.
Any Americans out there that are listening, can you please educate us on how your health system works in terms of covering the costs of a post-mortem, please?
When you say any Americans, I think majority of our audience probably is American. I mean, you've got the stats.
We've got a lot of Americans, actually.
Yeah.
I think it's the accent.
Are we novel?
I think so. Like, I've been accused of being posh before. During the autopsy, one of the assistant pathologists, a lady named Janet Miller, noticed an odd odour in the morgue as she was working. It was the unmistakable scent of bitter almonds, and she realised it was coming from somewhere very specific.
Bitter almonds?
Bitter almonds.
That's cyanide?
Cyanide. Well done!
I learned that from you because you said that when you murder me, it'll be with cyanide.
Did I?
Yeah.
Why did I tell you how to spot it?
Because, I don't know. It's something like you'd make it with almond milk in a cup of tea.
Sip it in some marzipan.
Yeah, all that.
But... yeah, that's what she was smelling, and it was coming from Sue's body. And an interesting thing about this as well, not everybody's actually able to smell the scent of cyanide. It's genetic. Only about 60% of the population can do it.
See, I just want to say,
yeah.
We've probably got more than a few listeners sitting there going, what the fuck? You talked about how you were going to murder each other?
Honestly, we're a very loving couple, I swear.
Yeah. But I'm rational enough to know that I'm quite annoying at times. So if anyone's going to be kind of pulling a trigger on that kind of thing, then I'm the one that's going to be mysteriously silent.
It's okay. You're fine. I've already said this once, this episode. You don't have a life insurance policy.
Yeah. So when I know.
You're okay.
So when we've got the life insurance,
then
I know,
you need to start to worry. Start taking and like counting down the clock, because at that point you've got 2 years.
Yeah. Love you.
Love you too. So yeah, not everybody is able to smell the scent of cyanide, but fortunately this pathologist, Janet, was one of the people that can. Cyanide is an extremely toxic compound that can be fatal to humans, and a lethal dose can be as low as just 100 milligrams. Just to put that into perspective for you, those paracetamol tablets that we get over the counter, they're 500 milligrams.
Mm-hmm.
So 1/5 of those of cyanide can be enough to kill you. Cyanide works by preventing cells from being able to absorb oxygen, and symptoms can set in within just 10 minutes of ingestion. Symptoms of cyanide poisoning starts with dizziness, headache, nausea and confusion, but within 30 minutes there will be extreme difficulty breathing, seizures, drastically low blood pressure, loss of consciousness and eventually cardiac arrest. Cyanide also has a very short half-life within the human body, and within a few hours it can no longer be found through toxicology testing. It was incredibly lucky that Janet Miller caught the smell of it in this case. Toxicology screens confirmed Janet's suspicions. Sue had died because of a massive dose of cyanide. What they needed to do now is find out where it came from. Paul gave Auburn detectives permission to search the family home, and they seized dozens of bottles of medication, both prescription and over-the-counter. They even searched the rubbish bins for discarded packaging. Paul explained to the officers that Sue would take Excedrin each morning, but that he had also taken 2 tablets from the same bottle earlier in the day while Sue was still asleep. All the medications were tested, but it was the Excedrin capsules that came back positive. There were several of the gel caps in the bottle filled with the deadly white powder, and it was a miracle that Paul had not also been killed. So in that bottle, there were 7 more tablets that were stuffed with cyanide.
Ooh.
Yeah, he got very lucky.
Mm.
Several years earlier, in 1982, there'd been a similar incident in Chicago where tainted bottles of Tylenol had been sold, and they too had been filled with cyanide. 7 people had been killed and the culprit has never been found.
Something on purpose, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a serial killer. They've got no idea who it was. They've never found out who it was. But yeah, just completely randomly, they were offing people and they started to think that this was a copycat, which is a really scary thought.
Mm.
With no other choice, detectives informed Bristol-Myers, the company that manufactures Excedrin, and a statewide recall of their products began across Washington. Hysteria spread through the state as shelves were stripped of medications with thousands of bottles worth of over-the-counter products. In 1986, there was no anti-tampering sales on these types of medication. It was just a cotton wool ball. Was stuffed in the top of the bottle to stop the pills basically rattling about and getting shaken apart, and then they put the lid on. So there's no full seal, there was none of those like clicky lid things that we have now that I am too much of a moron to be able to get into. I have to get a grown up to do it. but it was literally just a screw cap bottle with a bit of cotton wool stuffed in the top.
Like on TV.
Yeah, no seals or anything. So anybody could get into those pills.
That's not very safe.
Yeah. Then on June 17th, the police received a call from one Stella Nicol, who, when she'd heard about Sue Snow's death, realised that the circumstances to Bruce's were pretty much identical. Right down to the fact, Stella pushed police, that Bruce had taken a large dose of Excedrin before he collapsed. Stella demanded a further investigation into her husband's death.
What?
Yep.
But, huh? What?
Come with me on this very sinister ride. Bruce had already...
That's like saying, my husband has been shot. Also, I found a gun in my back garden.
Yeah.
Come and check it for fingerprints.
I'm really pleased that you don't understand what's going on here. That says so much, many positive things about your character. Just trust me, I'm going to explain to you.
Okay. I've got some theories, but let's see what happens.
Bruce was already buried, but the medical examiner's office still had a sample of his blood left over from the autopsy that they conducted. They ran a toxicology screen and sure enough, it came back positive for cyanide. Police searched the Nickel home and found not one, but two tubs of medication that contained poison capsules. According to receipts that Stella still had, they'd been purchased at two separate pharmacies. So she hadn't even been at a pharmacy and picked off two tainted bottles off the same shelf. They'd been bought at completely different places.
What the fuck?
Can you tell what it is yet?
Oh, I'm so confused.
I'm going to explain.
Again, I have theories, but I'm just trying to work out how the puzzle pieces stick together at this point.
As panic gripped the state of Washington, a grisly picture emerged. During their recall of the medication by Bristol Myers, two further bottles of tampered medication were found on store shelves. That brought the known total up to five altogether. It appeared there was a maniac out there poisoning people entirely at random. There was no connection between Bruce Nickel and Sue Snow, other than the circumstances of their deaths. Bristol Myers became so desperate for answers, they offered a reward of $300,000 to anyone who could bring information that would lead to the capture of the culprit. But something niggled at the investigators. Out of the 740,000 bottles of medication that they'd seized, what were the odds that Stella Nickel had ended up with two of them? It would have been one thing if the bottles had been purchased side by side from the same store, but in different shops on different dates?
But how did it get in the other house? They said there's no connection.
There's no connection at all between them. Nothing. The five bottles of medication were sent for further analysis at the FBI labs. There, a chemist who was working on them found something odd about the content of the poison capsules. Among the white powder of the cyanide, there was tiny, microscopic green crystals. These crystals were identified as trace amounts of an algicide, specifically the brand Algae Destroyer, a substance used to prevent algae from growing in fish tanks.
Algae Destroyer!
Yeah, so we've got Algae Destroyer just randomly showing up in these poison pills. When police had collected the two tubs of poison capsules from Stella Nickel's home, one of them had complimented her on the tropical fish tanks that she had.
Yeah, because they didn't she flush one of the kids' goldfish?
Yeah, ones? And she started collecting fish and was looking at setting up an aquarium business.
Okay.
The cogs are turning.
But how did it get into this other house?
Well, even so, as you say, Stella seemed an unlikely suspect. Why would she have come forward to demand police investigate her husband's death if she had been the one who killed him? What sort of murderer would want to call that kind of attention? Investigators went to the pet store where Stella had purchased her supplies, and there the clerk confirmed he had sold her the exact same brand of algicide that they'd found in the cyanide capsules.
Algae Destroyer!
Algae Destroyer! Combined with the fact that she'd ended up with two bottles of the poison medication, it was just too much of a coincidence to ignore. Detectives dug into Stella's background and found her history of fraud and child abuse. The woman who appeared to them as an amiable grandmother took a chilling turn the more they uncovered. Prior to Bruce's death, right back as far as 1985, Stella had started to take out life insurance policies on Bruce.
So I've got to watch out for you getting life mm-hmm. insurance on me and tropical fish.
But still, why was Sue Snow dead?
Yeah.
In November 1986, detectives had Nickel take a polygraph test, questioning her about her husband's death. She protested her innocence and appeared calm on the outside as she was questioned, but when the test results were read, she had failed. Now, just to be clear, polygraphs are not admissible in court as they're not reliable as proof of innocence or guilt. They're not lie detector tests, and frankly, no. I think polygraphs are kind of bollocks, and if you're asked to take one, never do, even if you're completely innocent, because stress can make, you know, the nerves of being interrogated by police can make you very easily fail a polygraph test.
Like, put me on a polygraph and ask me if I shot JFK. Oh. If I said no, it would say I'm lying.
I'm naturally, like, I have the joy of living with generalized anxiety disorder. I naturally have a resting heart rate of about 90 beats per minute. That's just my normal state. Can you imagine? If you put me on a fucking telegraph, a polygraph, they'd probably think I was the Zodiac.
Did you? Well, no, it's Ted Cruz.
He wasn't even born!
Did you kill JFK?
No, I didn't kill JFK. But I can actually feel my heart rate increasing just at the thought of having to do a polygraph.
Shit, you found out.
Just at the thought of having to do a polygraph and like how easily I would fail it. That's enough that my heart rate has increased. Sat here right now, I can feel it.
Okay, all right. Let's keep track on that heart rate, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Did you conspire with the Zodiac Killer, also known as Ted Cruz, to kill JFK?
There are so many things wrong with that sentence.
Did you?
No.
How's your heart rate?
It's kind of uncomfortable.
She did it.
But this is the thing. This is why polygraphs are not admissible in court, because they're total bollocks, because they pick up on stress. But the reason that they're still put to use is because basically it's psychological warfare. And if you fail a polygraph test and they think you're guilty, they can go, we know you're lying, we've got proof. And then sometimes that can put enough pressure on someone to elicit a confession. Unfortunately, it can elicit false confessions as well. So just never take a polygraph, guys, ever. Police needed more evidence if they were going to convict Stella of Bruce's murder. They looked further into the insurance policies, discovering that if Bruce died of natural causes, then Stella would be entitled to a payout of around $76,000. However, if Bruce's death was ruled as accidental, for example, caused by ingesting tampered medication, Stella would receive an extra $100,000. Here we go. Starting to slot together.
Yeah, but still don't know how it got in the other house.
The motive behind Sue's death suddenly became horribly clear. The additional bottles of poison had been placed in pharmacies at random, with the express intent of harming someone with absolutely no ties to Stella.
What a bitch.
Yep. She could then use Sue Snow's death as proof that Bruce's had been accidental via the same cause. Sue had been a completely expendable stranger. What kind of fucking psychopath can you be to do you have to be to do that to people?
Well, the same person that put the stuff in.
Oh, I know, but I cannot imagine being that void of empathy that you literally, and that could be a child or anything.
Mm.
You know, like, I'm not saying that a child's life is more valuable than Sue's, but just, I mean, poor Sue's family, she was murdered by a stranger for literally no reason.
Oh, for sure.
For $100,000, yeah. But, like, she had no ties to her. She had no idea who her target was. She just placed these poison medications all around the county, knowing that she was going to kill, you know, potentially many people.
They found four bottles.
They found five altogether.
Five, okay. And two of them were at shared house.
Yeah, so there was three out in the world with, you know, more than one capsule of medication in it. She could have killed so many people, and she just did not. She didn't have any issue with doing that. For $100,000.
Yeah.
The callousness is, it's just mind-boggling to me. I can't get my head around it at all.
She's a bitch.
Yeah. In January of 1987, Stella's daughter Cynthia, so the one she used to beat the shit out of,
mm-hmm.
approached police with further information. Finally done with being under her mother's destructive control, Cynthia explained that Stella had talked to her repeatedly about how bored she was of being married to Bruce, and that she was thinking of killing him.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She had tried to poison him once previously by dosing him with something called Digitalis, which is foxglove flowers. You know, they're mega poisonous. But all this had done was to make him drowsy, so he slept it off. When this hadn't worked, Stella told her daughter of how she'd gone to the local library to research various methods of poisoning. Police found 84 of Stella's fingerprints all over two books in particular. Human Poisonings from Native and Cultivated Plants and Deadly Harvest, A Guide to Common Poisonous Plants. In particular, these prints were concentrated on pages about cyanide.
Fuck's sake.
Both books had stamps marking that they had been taken out by Stella prior to Bruce's death.
Did she want to get caught?
For all, like, I think that Stella is a highly intelligent woman. I think the thing is, her ego is so vast that she never imagined that she'd be connected to any of this.
I think she was wrong.
Yes.
you know, being as she told her daughter, I'm going to commit murder by poison.
Yeah. You know? She used to complain about Bruce to her all the time. And I think she thought that because Cynthia had been so under her control previously, you know, the abuser.
She wouldn't do anything about it.
Yeah, victim relationship. Oy. On December 9th, 1987, Stella Nickel was indicted by a grand jury on 5 counts of product tampering, including 2 which resulted in the death of Bruce Nickel and Sue Snow. And in April of 1988, she went to trial. At the trial, one of the pieces of evidence that was discussed was the algae destroyer found within the cyanide capsules.
Algae destroyer!
Yeah, and they reckon that what she did, basically, is when she bought this algicide, she was told by the pet store clerk that she needed to crush it up before she added it to the water so that it dissolved properly. So they think that she had crushed this with something like a pestle and mortar, and then she'd use the same pestle and mortar to grind up the cyanide into a really fine powder that she could then open up the gel capsules and replace the medication with this powder inside.
Where did she get the cyanide?
It's fairly easy to get a hold of cyanide.
Yeah?
Yeah, from like... blah, blah, blah.
Oh, right, those.
From like industrial chemical companies and stuff. You think about it, it's used in rat poison and things like that.
Huh, okay.
It's fairly easy to get. I could probably get hold of cyanide. I'm not going to because I don't want to.
Not yet.
But I'm saying if you've got a little bit of knowledge, and bearing in mind she was researching like natural sources of this stuff as well, and the reason that almonds smell like almonds is because they have cyanide in them. So you can get it, and like apricot kernels and apple seeds and all that sort of thing, they've all got cyanide in them. So it might be that she sort of figured out how to extract it through her research, but you can also get it from all sorts of industrial companies.
And the foxglove thing?
Foxglove, you can grow that in the back garden. That was everywhere in our garden when I was a kid. But yeah, foxglove is a weed in this country. On May the 9th, 1988, Stella was found guilty of causing death by product tampering. This was the first ever incident of such a conviction in the United States. She was sentenced to 2 terms of 90 years each for the deaths of Bruce and Sue, with no consideration for parole until she'd served at least 30 years. This means that she was first eligible for parole in 2018 at the age of 75. Her request for parole was denied. Good choice, guys. Well done, parole board. I approve.
Get fucked, bitch.
This case, along with the Tynalol murders from 1982, brought about strict new anti-product tampering legislation in the United States, requiring that all medication be stored either in blister packs or vacuum sealed with a tamper-proof lid. Bristol Myers, Johnson & Johnson, who are the manufacturers of Tynalol, and other pharmaceutical companies also joined together to stop using the two-part split capsule design for their products and switch to a single-skinned caplet that could not be pulled apart and the contents replaced. So I think that's probably where things like, you know, you get the what they call like the liquid tabs that are the Nurofen little red capsules. Mm-hmm. That's what all of their products are like now.
Okay.
Cynthia testified against her own mother during her trial and was awarded $250,000, not pounds, dollars. I'm so fucking British, I'm sorry.
It would have gone further.
Mm-hmm. Of the reward money. Another $15,000 of the pot was given to the pet store manager who'd helped them with the information about the algae destroyer. Stella Nickel is serving her sentence in the minimum security, which I find a joke, but there we go, Federal Correctional Institution of Dublin, California. To this day, she protests her innocence and claims that her daughter set her up in order to collect the reward money. She denies ever abusing her children and claims that she researched cyanide only after Bruce's death, despite the book loan records in her name prior. She has also tried numerous times to make appeals and request retrials, but all of these have been denied. She's never actually been convicted of a murder charge, just death by product tampering. And just to kind of put your minds at rest in case she does ever try to get out again, she can still be charged with murder yet if the state decides that they want to do so. And that is the story of Stella Nickel, the Excedrin poisoner.
What a bitch.
What a bitch. She is horrible about her daughter, the things that she says about her daughter. She tries to implicate her daughter in it and all the rest of it. She tries to say her daughter helped her. And it's like the woman is living on another planet. As I say, I read Greg Olson's book, Bitter Almonds, and I do really recommend it because there is so much more information out there. But obviously, you need to condense it to get it into a sort of hour and a half podcast. But I strongly recommend that you go and read it. I'll put a link to the Amazon shop down in the source below. And just have a really good look at how... I don't even know if delusional is the right word. Yeah, she just absolutely flat out denies it and throws everything in the bus. She's never taken responsibility for anything that she's ever done in her life. And she's still fucking alive. And I genuinely think if she was let out, she would still be a danger to society.
Well, like we've said in like previous episodes, how much does narcissism come into this?
Oh, she's an enormous narcissist. Exactly. This one. I think she's a pure blood psychopath. I really do think that. She's got no conscience, no sense of empathy.
No. Well, she's putting bloody poisoned drug pots.
And yet somehow she managed to sort of sleep with all these people. I think it must have been because of her charm, because
she's not
seems...
her fucking looks.
Well, everyone just seems to absolutely adore her up until that point, and I cannot, you know, they all say how attractive she is, and I don't think it's a physical attractiveness. I think it was her charm, and that is another sort of trait of psychopaths. They're immensely charming, you know, they could talk you off a bridge, and she does seem like that. But she just makes my skin crawl. I've seen sort of interviews with her on, I think it was 2020. And she's just, she makes the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. Blech. Shudder. So do you have any questions at all? Because that was quite a condensed trip through that one.
I think you covered like any questions I might have had.
Cool.
I mean, main question was how the hell did these poison tablets
get
into this other house?
Just dumped them in random shops.
Because what I was starting to think is that she was boning the guy, or getting boned by the guy.
Yeah. No, and bless him, Paul was the initial suspect as well, because they had these kind of marital troubles. But he was absolutely devastated by her death. He really was. But he was questioned and submitted to polygraphs and all the rest of it. And he was, you know, fair enough, 9 times out of 10, the husband did it. But in this case, it wasn't. He was innocent. Just very, very sad, particularly Sea Snow. She had no part in this apart from falling victim to this woman's fucking greed. And again, this is another one of these cases where I'm just staggered by how little a human life is worth financially to another person.
Mm-hmm.
Very sad.
Well, like episode one.
Yeah.
That's the buff murderer.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you have a criminally stupid for me?
I do.
Yay.
I need a minute. Okay, so what was my criminally stupid last time?
Now, when you say last time, do you mean the one that the listeners haven't heard or the one before? Because there was another one in between.
The last one the listeners heard.
So that was the dickhead of a dad who was a robber who left behind his 8-year-old in the crime scene when he set the alarm off.
Oh, how much did he nick?
€5.
Yeah, about €5.
Yeah. So about £4.50.
Okay. So let's say, for example, if you were marginally more intelligent not to bring your kid when you're going to go shoplifting or stealing, what kind of planning would you put in place if you're going to go and acquire finances from a shop?
What, and I had a child or just
no,
in
no
general?
No child.
Well, first of all, you'd want to scope the place that you were going to hit.
Uh-huh.
Try and get an idea of the security systems and the CCTV around the location.
Uh-huh.
You'd want to make sure you're wearing things like gloves, a hat so you don't leave like hairs behind, because obviously I have lots of very long hair.
Yeah.
Some sort of face covering. You'd want to make sure that you've got something with you that enables you to get in and out of the building quickly, and some sort of swag bag. And then you'd want a clear escape route to make sure that you could get away fast.
So you wouldn't, for example, post on Facebook, doing Tesco over.
What? No.
A lad called Andrew Hennels, age 32, decided, you know what, I'm going to post a picture of myself with a knife and say, doing Tesco's over. He then went to Tesco's in the Gaywood area of King's Lynn, Norfolk, stole £410, and because he'd put this on fucking Facebook, he was arrested 15 minutes later.
Hey, good job, police. Well done. Yeah,
it was a bizarre and unusual case, said Sergeant Pete Jessup.
Oh, probably the easiest solve they've ever had.
Yep. They went on to say, the pictures and posts on Facebook helped us confirm what we already knew. None of this takes away from the seriousness of the crime or the trauma experienced by the victims.
Oh.
Judge Anthony Bate, when he was sentenced, said he was a high risk of serious harm to the public. You know, he'd run into a shop with a knife, stole £410 after putting it on his Facebook.
What an idiot!
So, yeah.
I hope they did him for armed robbery.
Let me just check.
If he had a bloody knife.
This
reminds me of a little anecdote, actually.
Yeah. He spent 4 years in prison, extended license. He also admitted to carrying a knife as an offensive weapon. No shit!
Fucking twat.
So,
you deserve everything you get.
So, yeah, that's our criminally stupid for
today. Well done, guys. Well, pro tip from our mate there. If you're going to turn a place over, don't put out an advert first. Although, saying that reminds me of something that happened to me a long time ago.
What did you steal?
I didn't steal anything. I foiled a crime because somebody announced it. So, I think it must have been about 16, 17. I worked in Sainsbury's local on the till. And at night when they were doing the cashing up, it used to be just me on the shop floor because the manager had to go back to dig the safe with someone else. So you only had one member of staff on the floor, and it was invariably fucking me because I was 16 and they could tell me to do whatever they want. And this very drunk guy walked into the store and went over to the Beers, Wines and Spirits and picked up this big old case of like Carlsberg or something and came and dumped it on the till in front of me and started sort of chatting away very drunkenly, very friendly drunk. But at the same time, he turned around and was like, oh, I'm going to rob that. And I sort of stood there going, oh, fuck, there's nothing I can do to stop him if he decides that's what he's going to do. And he started telling me about all about how he was going to turn the place over and all the rest of it. And there's me stood behind the till going, it's 10:30 at night at this point. There's no bugger around but me and him. And then he decides that actually he wants a sausage roll to go with his So he leaves the beer on the till in front of me and he's telling me, I'm going to go get a sausage roll. I'll be right back. I'll be going to get a sausage roll and then I'm going to come and I'm going to rob that. I was like, oh, yeah, okay, that's fine. Go on then. They're over there on that aisle and you go and get one and then come back. That's fine. And the moment he turned away, I grabbed the beer, tucked it onto the till and pressed the alarm underneath. And then my manager came out, who was this massive fucking baldy bodybuilder Polish guy. And by this point, the guy had realised that he'd nicked the beer. He'd come back with his sausage roll and he kicked off. And my manager came up behind him and I just saw this baldy head appear. And then this hand clamped down on the back of the guy's shirt and just yank him out of the shop. And the whole time I'm sitting behind the door going, he didn't hurt me. I foiled his plan.
Wow.
That was the closest encounter I think I've probably had to real crime. Somebody trying to nick a 12-pack.
Damn.
But yeah, he was the way he was just like, I'm going to rob that. But first I'm going to go and get a sausage roll and I'll be right back. Don't go anywhere.
And then he gets carried out the shop with a wet
carry
bag.
He didn't get carried out. He got dragged. He literally got him by the scruff of his neck, like he was an unruly kitten. And Marius was fucking huge. And he honestly looked like he belonged in the Polish mafia. But he was the sweetest, gentlest guy. I think he'd had his nose broken like 6 times or something. And he had all like cauliflower ears and stuff. You can tell that he'd been through it. And well, yeah, he just saw him kicking off and this head appeared behind this guy, sort of light gleaming majestically off his dome. And I was like, oh, thank fuck, I'm safe.
See, I think with people that thought they would get far having a fight with him, I think they quickly learned that breaking his nose does not give him pain.
Oh, yeah.
It just makes him angrier.
He was great. I mean, where I grew up is not very nice. It's rough. The armpit of the universe, as we affectionately called it. And I used to watch him, like, toss people out, like, physically throw them out all the time. You did not mess with him. But he was lovely. He was really, really nice.
I've done that once.
Hmm?
Yeah. I told you about this.
Oh, was this McDonald's?
Yeah. Years and years ago, when I was working at McDonald's, there was this, like, call it an army, because army implies strength. There was a gaggle of chavs causing shit at the McDonald's. They were trying to beat up one of the guys who was doing the litter pick.
Yeah,
but he's a guy that had been around the block, so he was pretty much just blocking every single pathetic swing they took.
Mm.
So I saw him, like, getting, like, piled on around the side, because it was all the glass windows along. So I went outside, picked a metal chair, shoved my way through them,
grabbed him,
pulled him through. They all started to scatter. I'm going back round to the front door. One of the leery little shits is trying to force his way in. So I look like your guy did. I grabbed him by the fucking neck. Justin. And he was
like a wet rag doll.
He was fucking airborne.
Oh my god. And, you're very heroic. Well done.
I shouted something. I can't remember what at him. And he scampered like a terrified puppy.
That's because you're enormous.
I don't know. I went indoors and had a cup of tea.
Good job. Well done.
Because the bloody manager was there. Vic is like, my god, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, I just really want a cup of tea right now.
The most British thing you've said so far.
I got my cup of tea. I sat in the crew room. I sat there just drinking it. She came in like 10 minutes later. I was like, you okay? I was like, fine.
Rage sipping.
Yeah. I'm fine. There's a hole in the wall in the corridor, though.
God.
He's like, that's fine. Don't worry about it. As long as you're okay. I'm like, I'm fine.
I'm fine.
I'm fine.
Oh, fuck me.
Yeah.
Right. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. And again, I'm really sorry for the delay. Just to explain why it was, if you didn't see on our social media, while the pandemic has obviously sort of set the world alight, I make face masks for people, and I had a couple of requests from a pregnant lady and a lady who has just come out of cancer treatment, so they wanted some for themselves and their family, and obviously stuff like that does have to take priority.
Yeah.
But I'm not taking any more orders now, because we are moving in approximately 6 weeks to Scotland. It's happening. We have somewhere to live. So there won't be any more delays, hopefully, now. And when it gets to that point, we'll start sort of doing a few pre-records so that we can make sure that while we're shifting, we don't let you down again. I'm really, really sorry. It's just been the worst week of luck. It really has.
But it's all working out, though, because while there's been bad luck, we've also got some movement on our moving house, which we've been wanting to do for...
2 years?
2 years.
2 years. Yeah. It's finally happening. Yeah.
Because we went up there on a little holiday for your birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And we were both like, I fucking love it here.
It's like being in Middle Earth. It was amazing. Yeah. So we're going.
Yeah. Mish is going to, you're taking a job up there. You're going to work from home, and I'm going to become a monster hunter. I'm serious.
I know you are. You know, we're really near, that really famous Scottish prison. Fuck. Begins with an S. Some Greenock. It's like not far from where we live. To cut this out, but it's where the Lockerbie bombers are.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, thank you very much for listening. A special thank you to lovely Kerry for being the first ever person that's actually said hello and joined our Facebook group.
Hello.
Please come and keep her company. She's so nice. And I'm kind of boring, I think.
No.
If you want to join our Facebook group, you can find it on the Book of Faces at Deviant, a true crime podcast. You can follow us on Instagram at Deviant Crime Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Deviant Crime Pod. You can also email us at deviantcrimepodcast@gmail.com. Feel free to send us case suggestions if you've got any criminally stupids. If you've got just any kind of stories or questions.
Fact corrections.
Yeah, fact corrections.
Especially anything to do with chromosomes.
Oh, fuck off. It's taken me three attempts to correct that. And yeah, also please rate, review and subscribe. You can leave us a review on Apple iTunes. We'd really appreciate it.
And we're a new podcast as well, so yeah. Feel free to share with your friends. It will do us a good service.
Please do, yes. Now that I've finished fulfilling my sewing obligations, our social media will pick up back in activity again. I literally haven't even had time to fart over the last couple of weeks, so there is a lull again now. Things will get back into a normal rhythm.
Now you've got time to fart.
Yes. I'm not doing that on the podcast, so that's gross. And also, as I say, later on in the week, probably Saturday or Sunday at the very latest, we will have a fun little mini-sode for you as a thank you for your patience while we unfortunately missed last week. I think that's about it.
Yeah.
Until then, stay safe. Wash your hands. Obviously, things are pretty bad again at the moment, but try and keep smiling. We're right there with you, and we'll speak to you soon.
And remember, if you murder anyone, tell us first so we can do the story.
No, don't tell us at all because we want to avoid culpability.
Bollocks.
We didn't teach you anything.
Apart from how to use cyanide efficiently.
Right, speak to you soon, everybody. Bye.
Bye.